The opinions expressed on this program are those of the program hosts and their guests and are not necessarily those of WSTU, St. Mary's Episcopal Church, and Temple Beit Haim. Products that may be mentioned are not necessarily intended as an endorsement. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited. And now, WSTU presents a priest and a rabbi. Call in with questions and comments at 220-9788. 220-WSTU. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, Stewart and Martin County and any other small little fragments that reach the radar of this antenna that is outside of this building. We are happy to have you on another episode of A Priest and a Rabbi Just Going Strong. It is me, Father Christian from St. Mary's Episcopal Church. And then to my right is the good-looking Rabbi Matthew Durbin. Matthew, Rabbi Durbin, how are you, my brother?
I am super. But my question as we start now, especially, you know, we are a few days after your busiest season besides Easter, I would assume.
Yes, sir.
So what was it like for you? How was it for you? Your Christmas celebrations, your plethora of dynamic services and the engagement of a wide community. I'm just amazed you're here.
Yeah. I've been sleeping for the last 2 days. It's been, we had about 34 services, but really about six, but they're all different. Every single one is different. So there's a whole different production value that goes between it. And it is a production between all of them. It involves a lot of times they involve kids. And you got to get a team of volunteers and these teams to support these kids, and then and you got musicians and you got services that go throughout the whole day.
So how does that work? I mean, obviously, as you said, you had six different services and six very different thematic services.
Yeah.
Do you and your senior rector, do you sit, say, 6 months before or a year before, and plan those services to say, okay, look, this children's service, I'd like to take it in this direction? Or, you know, as an example, you know, a couple of years ago, we went through, we do every year a Passover Seder. And in my former community, we spent a long time thinking about, you know, to get outside the box. So we use the major theme of anti-bullying and Pharaoh being the biggest bully. And use that in the guise of our Haggadah, of our story of Passover, underlaid with that notion of, you know, thou shalt not bully. In that context, I mean, do you and your senior director, I mean, do you guys both sit down and talk about themes or what main message you want to put across, and so that it's not the same every year? Or, I mean, how does that work?
We've added services or changed up the aesthetics of some of the services. So we moved one of the services, or we added a service outdoors. This is more of a location, so it changes the aesthetic. It's got candles. It's a neo-monastic feel. It's out in the courtyard, and we like to do that just because you could recreate the feeling of the shepherds underneath the stars, hearing the call from the angel that they need to go to the manger and see this Christ child. As an overall theme, that is a great, great, great thought, and I think one that might work really well for Lent as well, because Lent is what prepares us for Easter. And so Lent, you know, you have the 40 days, which that is where we do get themes. That is where we do get curriculum, or actually books that guide us as a church. We have a sermon series that's going to lead us through Lent to prepare Easter. But as in the actual services that happen, the culmination of that, that is a excuse me, a wonderful, wonderful idea.
And given the breakdown of your services, I mean, is there be said or read or chanted in some way? Is there a structure to it, or is it all just, you know, hymns and songs coming together?
Your services, the 8:30 and the 11, that's going to get you into the most traditional part, where you get those big traditional hymns, the big choir going. You're going to get the incense at the 11 o'clock. So that's going to get even what they would call more high church, Anglo-Catholic church, where there's going to be much more smells and bells going on. And then, you know, the dimming of the lights during silent night, where everyone's holding a candle in their hand. So there's these traditions of like Silent Night, usually in almost every church. Once you get to that point after the Eucharist, the lights will dim down and everyone will have a candle, and those candles will be lit by the person next to you. So it shows the light of Christ that was born from this, you know, born and placed in a manger that now spreads throughout this church. Hmm. And you take this light into the world. And now you have been fed and been given this gift of light. So that is a tradition. There are definitely tradition of prayers that happen, of the hymns. I mean, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, you know, Joy to the World. These are the big ones that are going to happen. Even at the big contemporary service that we had, which was in the Pinger Center, which is a kind of a big rec center, you have the band, and we had a pageant, but you're still doing a contemporary version of Hark the Herald Angels Sing or Joy to the World. We're not switching it up and doing like Amy Grant's version of, you know, oh, this is the Christmas song. I mean, we're the farthest we'll go is Mary, Did You Know, which is a controversial song. And I think in the Christian world, not a real controversial song, but some people think that, you know, what are we trying to say? Mary had no idea, you know, and Mary really had an idea here. What's going on? The angel told her, but
yeah.
In any event, but yeah,
I'm also curious to know, From your personal experience, right? You lead services, you said 6:30, and then you do like an 8:30, and then you do an 11:30. How do you manage? I mean, you're doing service after service after service in terms of not from a spiritual perspective, but from a standing up perspective. I mean, how do you as a priest gain the energy at 11:30 at night after you've led a whole bunch of services to still maintain that level of spirituality, that level of connection, that level of energy and excitement with these services at such a late time in the evening after you've done so much and prepared so much?
I think if it happened like every weekend, it would be insane. But this is once in a year, and the whole Christmas spirit comes in and just jazzes you up and drives you and gets you going. And you got to know the days leading up to it. You got to really take good care of yourself and hopefully prepare early enough on all your sermons. Because a lot of these services, I preached at three of them, and they all had to be three different sermons. Mm-hmm. So that you take the time. And a lot of times I couldn't because it was Sunday right before Christmas Eve. So I had to write a sermon for that Sunday. And so write a sermon for that, and then right after that sermon was complete, start working on all my Christmas Eve services. But I think it drives you. Father Todd and I talked about this. It's just the drive of Christmas. It's so exciting. It only happens once a year. There's so much preparation that goes into it, and you're so geeked that you got sometimes 200 to 300 people at a service. You know, and all these services. So you just go into one, into the next. And there's a ton of people there. There's a ton of people there that might have been dragged there, that might be totally excited to be there, that might be their first time in a church. And so you as a priest get excited being like, okay, hopefully we're creating a space where there can be some kind of transcendental moment for someone who's here, who came here with a lot of pain, hurt, loss, or is just new to all this and be like, wow. There's something that happened here. There's something that's real special, and I want to come back. And as a priest, that drives you. I mean, you're great to have all the folks who you're traditionalists who come, but it's the folks who are giving it a shot for the first time, or maybe been dragged there. That hopefully all the production that we put into it, all the time we put into it, and all the prayers that for the Holy Spirit to be present, that it would move someone's heart to be like, I think there's something going on here, and this might be a place where I can find my relationship with God.
Hmm. So I'm also interested in what you mentioned a little bit earlier of taking good care of myself before the Super Bowl of holidays descends on the Christmas season. So what does that mean for you? What does that look like in terms of taking care of yourself? How do you prepare? What does it mean for you to have self-care?
Brother, I'm still learning that.
Okay.
the Sabbath is so important. I mean, God is saying, listen, I'll give you 6 days to work your butt off. Work, work, work. But you've got to take that seventh day. You've got to rest, because that is how this human organism that I created for you, this temple that I created for you, that's how well it's going to operate. And when you try to start throwing work on top of that on the seventh day, you're going to crash. It's not good. Mm-hmm. So you need to be, and I want you to spend that time in love and in family and with friends and not doing work. So that's important. That's it, being really well prepared, which I'm still getting better at, because there's always stuff to do in the ministry. I took a couple naps. That helped tremendously, you know. And start early. Start early, start
when,
often.
When you're writing these sermons, I mean, are you writing them in your office, or are you taking the time to, I don't know, like most rabbis around the country, we read our sermons, especially around high holidays, in Starbucks or other cafes where we're out of the office, because we understand and we know, not to say that we're not approachable, but with that time of season, we know that if we are in the office or we're accessible, the community comes in, and it's very difficult to remain focused on the task at hand. When, as you know, through our professions, that we get pulled and steered in a variety of different locations and different ways. So, I mean, for you, do you sit in the office to write your sermons? Do you bounce ideas off your mom? Do you bounce ideas off your wife? Do you sit there in Starbucks and pull your luscious and beautiful hair? What does it look like? What does it look like for you?
I like the pulling of the luscious and beautiful hair, just sitting there in Starbucks, having some like chai tea latte with my hair, just pulling at it. And someone would be like, what is that guy? Oh, don't worry about it. He's just the priest down the street, just losing his mind over the 6 sermons he has to write. Just let him be, let him be. And I know priests who will actually go to a Starbucks or go somewhere, and they put a little sign that says, the priest is in writing a sermon. You're welcome to give me ideas as ways of engagement, but then you're not getting anything done if people come over. But yes, out of the office, absolutely. Every week, take a sermon day, because if you're in the office, nothing's going to get done. So you got to go off campus somewhere, whether it's at home, whether it's a coffee shop. And yes, that's what happens. Now this year I got lucky, because my mother, who's still in town, who's going to be coming in on the second segment here. And my wife were there, where I could immediately in the moment start bouncing ideas off of them. So the picture was them sitting on the couch, them like decorating the Christmas tree, and me pacing around in a circle, bouncing ideas, being like, okay, so what about this? Okay, so you got the shepherds, and they're out there, and they're waiting, right? They're waiting. And then the angel comes, and they hear the angel, and they're like freaked out. But then they're like, wait a minute, we got to run. We got to go. So we got to sprint to the manger. So what if I do this whole thing on like sprinting? And then my mom's like, uh-huh. So what does that mean? We're all supposed to be Carl Lewis and just like do sprints? I'm like, no. This idea, this excitement, this joy. We need to seize upon the joy of Christmas, because we can't just be lackadaisical and just collect presents. They're like, okay, give me more. Can you give me more with that? Okay. So that was extremely helpful, actually, to have my wife, who's very straightforward, and is not afraid to be like, that is not good. My mother's pretty similar too. So,
do you ever access, say social media in that regard? You know, I've seen a lot of rabbis, who will post, you know, a couple months before high holidays and say, what would you like your rabbi to write about or to speak about this new year? And you know, they'll do it with, you know, I do it with my colleagues. I bounce ideas off my colleagues, and get ideas. But I came across it a couple of years ago, and I thought, wow, what a brilliant way, because it's opening it up not only to your own community, but to, you know, from a reform perspective, you know, hundreds of other congregations where people may be saying, you know what, I want to know how I can gain meaning this new year. I want to know how I can access, you know, spirituality, or, you know, whatever major topic may be out there. I think it's incredibly interesting to hear, not from a clergy perspective, because I think what inspires us may be very different to what inspires our community. And to be able to hear from our community to say, well, actually, this is what I'd be interested in hearing. You know, have you ever thought about that, or in terms of ever access social media?
We've not through social media, but I got a mentor of mine, Carol Anderson, was mentioning this idea of you call about 10 parishioners and you go and seek, you know, can I have coffee or tea with you and sit down with them and just ask them, how are you doing? What's going on? What are you seeking? What are you needing right now from your church? What's on your heart that you would love to hear a sermon series on? Or just not even talking about that, just saying, how are you? What's going on? And then visiting 10 different people and seeing what the common themes are and being like, wow, I visited 10 parishioners and 6 of them are talking about fear of financial security. Mm-hmm. So how are we as a church going to respond to that? You know, what are we going to do? Is that going to be a sermon series? Is that going to be a class? Is that going to be bringing in a seminar series of financial peace? You know, the whole Dave Ramsey course, whatever it may be. But I love this idea of, because most of our St. Marians, really, it's more of a Facebook kind of crowd, a little bit of Instagram, but to just directly engage and say, what in this new year would you love to hear a sermon series on? Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. It's letting go of thinking the clergy just has all the thoughts and ideas. Absolutely. That we're the ones who come up with it. No, I mean, it really, it's what do the people want? I mean, liturgy means the work of the people. So we really need it. And the sermon is part of the work of the people. So responding again to the community, responding again. So I think that's it's a brilliant idea. Hmm. Yeah. And I'd love to try given that.
How many sermons we give a year. And I started kind of thinking about it the other day of, you know, I give anywhere from 50 to 55, almost 60 sermons a year. You know, I do a lot of them. And, you know, you amortize that out over 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. That's a tremendous amount of material and theme and access that, you know, sometimes we get kind of lost in the mire of everything else of kind of having that fresh perspective of saying, you know, Rabbi, I'd like to know how I can best access A, B, or Z.
Yeah. And there's a great director that he bring the, maybe 2 months in, 3 months in, and introducing to them current events that are happening in the world. And saying, how does this now affect the way that we interpret the story, to keep that story fresh so you're not just doing the same story over and over and over again, that you have this play, the story that you're telling, of course, and you have a commitment to that, but also the context of where you're telling the story, of what's happening in our world, and just to keep it fresh, just to keep it, because, you know, you and I are preaching every single weekend. Right. And then during the weekdays as well. Mm-hmm. Right. And are definitely affected by the current events. Mm-hmm. And I think our trick is, how do we preach on the current events, knowing that some of these current events are very divisive, that divide people. So, but we can't ignore it and say, no, I'm just going to talk about the nice stuff because that's what makes people feel good. Mm-hmm. No, it's taking on the hefty topics without alienating. But where do we find Jesus, God, in the midst of this, and how do we dialogue with one another? How do we try to suss this out? I mean, I think that's the true challenge of a good preacher, is knowing that you do have, and a lot of congregations do have, right and left sitting in the pews. How do you honor both, make it about God, and not get everyone turned off saying, he's getting too political, when you're saying, well, this is a hot topic. And we can't ignore this as a religious community.
You know? And how do you as a priest try and, you know, move from impactful sermon as opposed to a preaching sermon? I mean, I'll say to my wife every now and then when, you know, I write a sermon and I'll deliver it in front of her, and I said, was that too preachy? Because I don't want it to be preachy. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not about, you know, I remember when I was a kid growing up, I had a senior rabbi, who was very well written, just very prolific, just an amazing, amazing model of what a rabbi should be. And, you know, his approach was, when he addressed the congregation, it was never, this is what you need to do. It was, we as a community. He brought you in. And it wasn't to make you feel bad or to put judgment on you, but it was, you know, how do we move out of this space to a more accepting space, or, you know, and this is a guy who literally would give on high holidays 45 minutes to an hour sermon. I'm sure with my community, if I gave an hour sermon, I'd certainly hear about it either during or certainly moments thereafter.
Sure.
But, you know, for him, 45 minutes to an hour, you'd sit there as a congregant in the pew. And by the time you were finished, I mean, it felt like it was 2 minutes. I mean, he just engaged you and enwrapped you in the feeling so that when you left, you actually felt with this notion of, you know, I can do something, or that really spoke to me in some way, but not in a preachy, I'm better than perspective.
Sure.
Is it for you? Did you find it's trying to find that healthy balance between the two of not being overly in your face while at the same time trying to make it accessible for? Yeah,
absolutely. And a lot of times you have to just make it about the scripture. That's what I found, is make it about the scripture, make it about Jesus. Because if I try to say to make it about my own ideals or my own values or what I think is right, it's the boat will start sinking. People will just tune off and be like, well, there goes Christian off on his own thing, and whatever, and any kind of thoughts they might have about what my take would be on this issue. But if I can just stay as married as possible by saying, hey, this is what the Bible says, this is what scripture says, and just stay there and work through it. And yes, if you get too preachy, if you even lean in into like 15% preachy, you risk losing people. And people say, well, yeah, but you got to speak the truth. Yeah, but you also want to keep people on board so they listen.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have the dialogue. So there can be transformation. So the Holy Spirit can work through the congregation. So once you go into preachy mode, you can risk losing half the folks. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a mentor tell me once it's always going to be a hot issue, but immigration,
mm-hmm.
you know, say so you got to be careful how you approach that, because if you go too far into one area, half your people are just going to like mm-hmm. press the off button. And now what good is that? Now they're not even listening. Right. So how do you do that soft dance where you can be tender and open and inviting, but also be bold to say, this is where scripture is saying, what do we want to do with this?
Mm-hmm.
And where does God call us to see each other? So that's a challenge, you know, it's a challenge. So, you know, so we were able to bring back, my mother back by popular demand. People were like, wow, we loved your mother in the studio. Miggity Mike, the producer, was like, come on, can you get her back? Can you get her back? So my mom is still in town. So when we get back from Comercial, we will be talking a little bit just about this idea of this, continuing a little bit about call, right? The difference between what does it mean to be called as opposed to a vocation or a job? Is being a rabbi a job? Is it a vocation? Were you called by God? And then vice versa also for a priest. And then also, what is that call? Like, what does it mean? What is the job? Like, what is, if you had to give an elevator speech of what does it mean to be a rabbi? You know, what is that job? What does it mean to be a priest? What can you give a job description of what that means? And having my mom in here, she's going to have some questions about that as well. And asking from a Judaic perspective as well. And so we're going to get into that when we get back. So we'll see you. And also, any questions you might have about what does it mean to be a rabbi? What does it mean to be a priest? What does it actually go into creating that job description? Please give us a call. We love phone calls. We love having your points of view. 772-220-9788. That's 772-220-9788. All right, we'll be right back. Part two, segment two of A Priest and a Rabbi. This first episode that we had after Christmas is the second episode after Hanukkah, right? Tell me I'm right. Am I using my numbers correctly?
Three weeks.
3 weeks. Come on, Christian.
Sure.
Yeah. So. So we're back getting well rested from these busy holidays. And the job, we brought in my mom because she's always got such great questions and interesting background of growing up in an Orthodox neighborhood as well. And as we revealed last week, she was actually in the convent at one point, which clearly did not work out because of, well, I'm here right now. So thank you, Mom. And she went off to become a lawyer instead. So just, studying a different law or maybe the same. So we are here. So, Mom, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great okay. to be here.
Great introduction, huh? Just go right to the convent thing. Don't always. You love that.
She hates it
when I mention that. So, but Mom, we've talked about this before, and I think you had a question about, what is this difference between call, vocation, job, and what is that? How would you even describe that, what it is? So so you had a question, I think, for the rabbi, because you and I have talked about this itself, is do we see this as a call? Do we see this as a job?
Well, what I'd been thinking about since the last show was, if somebody asked me, what does a priest or a minister do? I've got a great idea of what I know the major job duties, as it were. I think it would be helpful for people in a community like Stewart to have more information, have a better idea. What would you say are your major duties?
It's a great question.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, I'm joking. I think both for myself and certainly for your son, I mean, I think we have our vocational responsibilities and our duties are very similar. Mm-hmm. I would say for a rabbi, my main description, so to speak, is to serve the Jewish people, to serve and to build community. So, beyond the obvious things that as a rabbi I perform, I mean, I'm there for counseling. I do a lot of marriage counseling. I do a lot of grief counseling.
Is marriage counseling required?
No.
Okay.
Let me rephrase that. It's highly encouraged.
Okay.
But as opposed to, and again, I could be wrong with this from a Catholic perspective, is that my understanding with a Catholic priest is that if one wants to get married in the Catholic Church, it's non-negotiable.
Right.
As a rabbi, I highly encourage marriage counseling. The things to think about before you get married. We had my wife on this on the program a little while ago, and when we went through marriage counseling, it was the furthest thing from my mind. I grew up in a very reformed community. My parents never had met with the rabbi before for marriage counseling. They met with the rabbi before just to talk through service, and this is what they wanted. I do meet with a lot of our wedding couples numerous times, partly to talk through what does it mean financially. If you are blessed with children, how would you raise them? What type of home would you create for them? Looking at other challenges that may present itself through married life, for as we know, it is it's not easy, nor should it be. And I think it's about a compromise. It's about relationship. So we do a lot of, I do a lot of marriage counseling. I do a lot of grief counseling as well. A lot of preparation for life cycle events, whether it be baby namings or unfortunately with us, we do a lot of funerals and a lot of bereavement issues. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it, which I think a lot of people don't see, is when you have a life cycle event like a wedding or a challenging moment like a funeral, it's not as if, the moment of death, we contact the rabbi, and then 2 days later, the rabbi shows up and just does a service. Because I think, what at least my practice is I will meet with the family numerous times. I don't want to go into it cold if I didn't know the person. I believe in authenticity. I believe in really representing. So a large part of it is, meeting with the family at the funeral home to go through, the process itself.
Can I interrupt for a moment? Is it common practice for you to do like deathbed visits?
So yes, we do, unlike the Catholic version, which would be last rites, as rabbis we certainly don't perform last rites, but we do have a process in Judaism called vidui, which is known as personal confession, and it is it is to in a formal sense to be recited by the one who is ill. Nine times out of 10, when I'm called in, it is, for lack of a better term, it's a little too late. Mm-hmm. That, you know, nine times out of 10, the one to whom I'm serving is either non-communicable or is unavailable to speak. So in that semblance, what I do is I provide for the family the opportunity for their vidui, their personal confession. And to say it in terms of, it's not to say, you know, Mom, you never gave me this, or I'm really, you know, really my whole life, you could never get me, you know, HBO. I really wanted HBO and you were just a terrible, miserable mother. It's more in terms of having that release to be able to say, you know, Mom, thank you for everything you've given me. And if I haven't said it enough, I want to tell you, I love you. And really to be able to be present and to be in the moment itself, you know, especially with those that have been struggling with illness for a long time, as I'm sure, you know, Father Anderson, you would agree with, is that, you know, there are times we will say to the families, you know, give you a private moment, but I think it would be really impactful and very meaningful to say to your loved one, however challenging this phrase and this understanding is, and I know it's tough, is to be able to say to your loved one, it's okay, you can go. And it is having that release. And I know the words are easier said than done, because when we see our loved ones suffering, it's heart-wrenching. We don't want to see them in that way. So beyond the bereavement issues, I teach and prepare our kids for bar and bat mitzvah. I teach a variety of different adult education classes. As a rabbi, I also I work with a lot of young families. So it's the whole kind of gambit of everything that we perform. A large part, too, is also within the wider community, just so people are aware that, you know, we exist and, you know, we're not strangers. We're not alien people. We don't hide our horns until, you know, the full moon comes out and at midnight, and trying to change some of those stereotypes. But a large part of also what I would assume the progressive rabbis, certainly myself included, is to do exactly what Father Anderson and I are doing right now, which is to develop a relationship, develop a very strong friendship, so that at the end of the day, we can really bounce ideas off one another, promote each other's respective communities, and to kind of break down some of those boundaries that exist through either, and I don't want this to come across negatively, but, you know, to remove some of the ignorance and the stigma behind, you know, what our respective, you know, religious faiths, you know, talk about.
Okay. I have another question, a follow-up question. As I understand it, and this may be an incorrect understanding, that Reformed Judaism, that the basic mission of Reformed Judaism is very strongly oriented towards social justice. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
So, yeah, let's just take a brief step back. In the larger context, absolutely. Reformed Judaism comes out of Germany in the 1800s. And what the early reformers wanted to do was to really create a movement that was based on values and ethics, living a good and deserving life. Part of the challenge with the early reform movement was also the challenge of assimilation. We need to assimilate into the local culture, especially in America. That's what we had done. Let's not ruffle too many feathers, for the fear that if we ruffle too many feathers and assert ourselves in a certain way, look what our brothers and sisters experienced with the pogroms in Eastern Europe and Russia. So we were very meticulous in what we wanted to achieve, but the major push was really about those strong values and ethics. And I do the same when it comes to conversion classes, to which I teach as well. And I say to a lot of our students, you know, let's learn about, say, dietary laws. Let's learn about the laws of kashrut. But at the end of the day, those laws are a personal choice to which you make. Right? I'm not going to say, well, I'm sorry, I can't continue with your conversion because you're not going to keep kosher. You know, that to me is not my concern. My concern is we understand its biblical origins, why it was written, why, what the impact is, but largely about, you know, the fact that it is a personal choice to which you and your family make. But I would say, as a Reform Jew, that the values and ethics of being a good and deserving person, supporting a community, giving with a free and open hand, that those social values, that those are non-negotiable, that that's what we strive for. So social justice has always been really at the top end of the reform movement. Mm-hmm. In the 1950s, we started in New York City a commission of social action, which was under the guise of, at that time, what was called the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, our major movement. And after the 1950s, in the late 60s, but certainly by 1971, we created an offshoot of a commission of social action to what we have in Washington, D.C., which is known as the Religious Action Center. And they lobby, they advocate for all humanitarian issues, mm-hmm. for issues of Israel. They were very instrumental with the migration of Eastern Europeans and Russian Soviet Jewry into Israel and mm-hmm. and throughout the world to get them out of the Iron Curtain and the challenges that existed. So they are really there in a modern day context. After Hurricane Katrina, you know, the reform movement was really the first on the ground to offer aid, support, help in everything that we did with beyond just synagogues, but churches and other areas as well. And we're also global. We're around the world. I may have mentioned my wife went on a mission trip about 10 years ago to Senegal. And she was under the American Jewish World Service that tries to help and educate others in more challenging countries around the world. So for her, it was, you know, going off to Senegal for 3 weeks and to build latrines for the local population, because for them, they just didn't know any better. So some of these, you know, mud brick houses that they were living in, they would be cooking their food, but not to be graphic, but also defecating literally inches away from where their food was with very little, if any, ventilation. So, you know, what the American Jewish World Service did was they went in and built latrines outside and informed and educated the community so that they could kind of serve for their own. You know, we have one of our very famous philosophers, rabbis, doctors, Maimonides, about 900 years ago, gave a level of giving of each level higher than the next. And of course, the highest level, which slightly comes out of almost like a Russian proverb, is, you know, the famous adage that says, do not give a man a fish, but give him the tools so that he may fish for himself. And Maimonides said, do not give somebody something, but give them a loan, a gift, so that they may empower themselves and give them the tools and the skills so they can kind of, you know, fend for themselves. And I think that from a reform perspective, is really trying to get into both the Jewish community and certainly the wider community to say, look, we're not insular. We're not only just concerned with our own people. We're concerned with everyone on the planet. And I think it is very much a reform ideology, which is to say, you know, we are here. But social justice has always been a major focus, certainly of the reform movement, to which later subsequent movements like conservative Judaism and certainly Orthodoxy have taken on in their major platforms. But that's been.
Yeah, this idea that you said of instead of giving a fish, you know, you give a man, you teach a man to fish, right? Mm-hmm. And when I think about this job description of being a priest, a lot of times it's our job. If I had to really whittle it down, I'm talking like the Twitter description of what it means to be a priest is to empower the laity. It's that hopefully that what we are doing at St. Mary's, hopefully what Father Todd and myself and the staff, is that we are doing the teaching and the preaching and the empowering and the training that's empowering the laity, the folks, to be able to go out into the world and do the good work that needs to be done. So it's not all put upon the clergy's lap. The clergy's job, as much as I would love to be to go out and be an evangelist, and I like being an evangelist and doing things out in the public square, really what's more impactful is that if I'm spotting and being like a talent scout mm-hmm. in my own congregation, seeing the people who have that maybe a small passion or a growing passion for being an evangelist, getting them together, training them, teaching them, and talking about, okay, now we got this team together. How do you guys want to go out and to be able to, what does evangelism sound like to you? What does it look like? For everything, a healing, healing team, you know, a healing ministry, training and finding the people who feel called to healing, and then training them and developing them and forming them and praying with them and inviting the Holy Spirit to anoint them so they can be the ones to go out to the hospitals and go out to homes and in, and into the community itself. So it's, I don't know if you've, if a lot falls upon the clergy's lap, but I know that we do a disservice, I think, if we are not, if we accept all that falls onto our lap, but they like, oh, that's just the thing the priest does, as opposed to saying, okay, great, there's a need here. How do we empower all these growing Christians or growing Jews to be the ones to take ownership, to take ownership of this call? So I'm learning more and more how can, because it's easy to just say, well, I'll just do it because it'll be faster, be more efficient, et cetera, et cetera. But that, to me, it's not just delegating, it's empowering and forming. It's Christian formation of people to step into their mission, step into their call. How is God calling them? And if I just feed them a sermon on Sundays, maybe get them on a Wednesday for some class, but not really allowing them to pray and to step into this call that God is giving them. So now this is where the call comes back in. Call is not just the call to the priesthood, that we've all been called. You know, Isaiah's, the call is always there. It's all over. And find, helping people find their call, training them, empowering them to be life group leaders, small group leaders, to start a mission inside of Martin County, to go off and do social justice, supporting them, giving them the resources, as much as we would want to be on the forefront as the priests or the staff, it's really lifting up these other leaders. So I don't know if you find that as part of your job, which is really to really power and lift up your congregants, which can be a challenge because there's just, there's so much competition out there right now. And if we're not in the 1950s anymore, where religion was just expected. And it's a trick is igniting people's heart on fire.
But I think that that's also the shift that religious institutions have opened up to and have experienced and certainly brought towards their respective communities. You know, we have a caring community, which means, you know, I have a committee that to which I sit on. I have, you know, 10, 12 volunteers who sit there. We determine in terms of, you know, nursing facilities and areas around holiday seasons or for those who, you know, would want the opportunity to speak with me or my caring community, right? I think we adapt to our social surroundings to which we recognize, look, not everyone is walking through the doors of a synagogue. For some, you know, a lot of the nursing facilities that I visit, you know, a lot of them can't move. You know, their cars have been taken away or they're
you
either
make in those visits. Like how often are you visiting? So, Mom, you had that question of how often are you doing it as opposed to a lay person?
So, we typically do go to, anywhere from 15 or 20 of our nursing facilities from a little bit further north of Stewart, you know, Jensen Beach, even a little bit further in Port St. Lucie, all the way down to Hope Sound and a little bit further south than Hope Sound. We typically go around the high holidays, so around Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur.
We being whom?
Myself and members of my caring community.
Okay.
We go around Hanukkah, and then we'll go again around Passover.
Now, what about during the weekdays when you know that someone...
Do you have regular hospital visits?
So I do hospital visitations. Those in and of themselves are for when members of the community or even those that are not members of the community, when they reach out to us to say, look, Rabbi, you know, my mother, my son, my daughter's in the hospital. You know, we would appreciate a visit. Or I get calls from the chaplain, Chaplain Dave down at Martin, who will call and say, so-and-so is looking for a rabbi. In my former community, which was really interesting in terms of hospital visitations, because it was a small regional hospital and as a on-call chaplain, I had access to records. So I could go into the chaplaincy department. I can enter in my code and I could type in Jewish or Judaism and it would show me every single member in the hospital to, or any patient that is in the hospital who is Jewish. That way I could do my visitations. today, certainly in our hospitals and most hospitals around America, that's just not, I mean, there are HIPAA laws. You just can't do it.
Right.
So, and my practice has always been, you know, if someone were to call and say, Rabbi, I'd like to meet with you in 3 days from now, and I'm at Martin Memorial, you know, I will call either the day before or usually the day of, maybe a couple hours before, just to make sure that they are feeling okay and they would still like a visit. Because I'm also very cognizant that, you know, feeling may change, right? If I have an 11 o'clock at Martin Memorial, at 9 o'clock, the person may feel, I don't really feel up to it. And instead of just barging in and saying, you know, I'm here, to be able to make that call to say, are you still available? Would you still like to meet with me? Yes. Okay, great. I'll be there at 11 o'clock or 3 o'clock.
It's an interesting part of being a clergy member, whether it's any denomination, is the visitation. Mm-hmm. The visitation's at homes, at rehab centers, at the hospitals. And we, you know, we have a caring ministry that goes, and they're wonderful. They're incredible. But sometimes the people, they just want the pastor. They just want Absolutely. The rabbi. They just want the priest.
And in that context, you know, we do say to a lot of our facilities, whether it be assisted living or non-assisted living, you know, although we come 3 times a year or 3 or 4 times a year, we are not limited just to that. Like if you would want to meet with me, the rabbi, or any of my caring community, you know, your facilities manager has our information. Feel free to reach out to us at any time. So, you know, a large part of it is the visitations that I perform, that I go off, whether it be home visitations, hospice.
Once a week?
Usually maybe 2 days a week.
Yeah.
You know, it really depends. I mean, there's sometimes that, as I say to some of my community, look, there's sometimes that I could be in my office for 7 minutes for the entire day. There are times I could be in my office for 12 or 14 hours. It really depends on the nature of the day, what I know is coming up. And really, you know, I think part of the biggest challenge for rabbis and certainly for priests is, and I will be the first to admit that I am not 100% great at it, is time management.
Yeah.
You know, Absolutely. How do we find time for not only on a personal level for ourselves, but how do we find times where, you know, we can provide that, that level of meaning and that level of comfort, while at the same time not overextend. You know, and there have been times where, you know, I have an hour break between appointments and the hospital will call and say, Rabbi, somebody needs to meet with you. Are you available, you know, in an hour? I'm not available in an hour. I'm available right now. Okay, would you mind? I'll be there in 5 minutes. You know, and then being cognizant that I have to be back at a certain time and I don't want to rush a family. But at the same time, it's trying to take, you know, I take my cues largely from the family. You know, if I go in and, you know, somebody, I'm visiting with somebody after, you know, 20, 30 minutes, you know, I can recognize, okay, you know what, this is a lot. Let's be in touch. I will contact you later. I will call you tomorrow to see how you're feeling. And I think a large part of those things get kind of wrapped into it.
Yeah, because my mom and I were talking about this yesterday about, you know, what would it be like if you called the church and say, hey, I would like someone to visit me at the hospital, and then, you know, you had someone from the caring ministry show up. Mom, what did you say?
Well, I'm really sick or dying. Mm-hmm. I don't want a lay person. Mm-hmm. I want the real guy. Mm-hmm. I want the Absolutely. Rabbi. I want the priest.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that's the truth what comes with it. So time management is just so key, right? How do you get in there? How do you, especially if you have to drive a certain amount of a distance and get in there and to be present and to be, and really be a holy presence, to bring comfort, a pastoral presence to the family or the whoever is there, but then also be cognizant that you have a 2 o'clock finance meeting or whatever, or 3 o'clock this, or maybe another pastoral meeting. You got to get 4 or 5 pastoral mm-hmm. visits in, which can happen. So, but my mom, like you were saying, is like, you know, most people they want the clergy.
Mm-hmm. That's some cheap substitute, and I don't mean that in a denigrating
way. No, absolutely, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So some of it is a cultural thing. I think all of it's a cultural thing of just you feel more, I don't know if you feel more honored if it's a clergy member, if it's the rabbi that shows up, if the priest shows up. I remember my when I did my internship, the priest who was supervising me said, just accept that you're going to let people down. You're going to let people down because there's all the stuff that's going to fall on your plate, and you got to manage your time, and you got to manage all this, and you're going to have to delegate. You're going to have to farm it out. And some people are not going to be happy with that. But if not, how are you going to keep this organism moving if you're just constantly bouncing around town where you've got to be doing a lot of other things? I mean, there's just so many hats you wear as a minister. Mm-hmm. So real quickly here, can you give me the Twitter description of what it means to be a rabbi? What the job description of a rabbi? 140 characters.
All encompassing.
That's the job.
I think you know to give the Twitter feed on it, you know, it's everything and anything. You know, from life cycle events to, you know, personal connections to teaching to fundraising to building community to being out in the wider community to, you know, I think if I were to compartmentalize and really say it in two words, it's all encompassing. It's everything.
Cool. Mom, any kind of final thoughts here?
No, I was, I don't think we have time, but one option that is for you guys to explore maybe in your next show is what's happening more and more frequently is mixed marriages and people wanting to honor both traditions. Mm-hmm. Both, and I've seen it happen in Chicago, and you guys could talk about that sometime.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that. Mm-hmm. That
it's great.
Mixed marriages. What does that look like? Mm-hmm. And then what are the, and I know there's some or they're more successful than others, you know, the Catholic Jewish connection. So some final thoughts here is, you know, when we talk about this idea of call, vocation, job, do you out there who are listening, do you feel the job that you're doing, have you been called by God to do it? Do you feel like it's a calling, whether you believe in God or you don't believe in God? And how do you nurture that? So how do you find that higher calling that is leading you, that gets you out of bed in the morning and saying, you know what, I'm good at this. I've been given a gift of this. I feel like I'm really serving a greater good. And if you don't, what's the thought, the prayer that you lift up that can help you maybe change the perspective on what you're doing out there to see that you do it with meaning and purpose and that there's a higher power working through you from any kind of job that's out there, that you're part of a bigger scheme and God has called us in all different ways. We'll be back next week. God bless you and a happy new year to you all. For Rabbi Matthew, for my mom, for myself, God bless you.